From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 60 for Friday, the 27th of January, 2012. On the show this week, the idea for temples for Britain's atheists takes a step forward towards reality. The most worrying internet law to be considered in recent years gains ominous support from the EU. And a presidential hopeful in the US has astonishing plans to build a base on the moon. All that and more coming up over the next 30 minutes. Ahoy, I'm Nate Langston, I'm the editor of wired.co.uk, and joining me, of course, news editor Duncan the Gear.
Hello.
And Olivia underscore the Solon.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Now, Liv, you told me something earlier that I'm convinced is not true, but were you drinking vodka at your desk?
I may or may not have been drinking vodka at my desk.
Do not confirm rumours or speculation.
No. I neither confirm nor deny that I was drinking vodka at my desk.
Okay, well, I'm on my sixth espresso now, so I'm... High as a kite. But we've got an amazing show coming up. And first, actually, the story that I think is most important we talk about is to do with probably one of the most important laws we have written about, at least in terms of European internet policy. And this is a thing called ACTA. And it's very, very important. Everyone knows about this because it has a very dangerous repercussion, I guess, if it goes through. Liv,
yes,
what's ACTA?
ACTA is the latest bit of alphabet soup. We've had SOPA, we've had PIPA, and this is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. And what it aims to do is establish international standards for intellectual property rights enforcement. It's kind of been murmuring in the background for about 4 or 5 years, but it's being really gearing up now, and people are beginning to ratify this treaty.
So why is it so problematic?
It's problematic for a number of reasons. The first is that it calls itself a trade agreement, and these are normally fairly non-controversial and are as such are negotiated often behind closed doors and don't tend to be debated in Parliament. However, under this particular trade agreement, they have criminal sanctions for piracy and for people accused of aiding and abetting copyright infringement on what they call a commercial scale, which is not defined particularly clearly.
So this is to do with people potentially downloading things off BitTorrent, stuff like that.
Yeah, it talks about any website that allows people to infringe copyright on a commercial scale. So this could be a blog that happens to have loads of loads of followers, loads of traffic, and it might have a video on it that would have some music that they don't have the rights to have on that video, and theoretically that site could be deemed to be aiding and abetting copyright infringement.
And the site's operators could have criminal punishment.
Could have criminal.
So we're talking jail, fines.
Punishment. But even if you don't agree with making copyright law more relaxed online, the main problem is that the way that it's been done, the way that the Act has been pushed through, it's been done in a fairly undemocratic way with a highly secretive process, with none of the papers being released about it. And actually, some of the people in the meetings had to sign NDAs, which they weren't allowed to discuss the contents of that meeting with their actual country governments.
But where does the copyright bit come from? Because I thought you said it was the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement.
Yeah, this is one of the really... interesting things about a lot of these laws is that they bundle together counterfeiting and copyright into the same breath.
Well, so a bit like sex and violence.
It's like sex and violence in the old Mary Whitehouse case. So counterfeiting is when you deceive the person receiving the counterfeited goods into believing that it's real. So that could be knockoff luxury goods, handbags, or worse, medicines. However, it's being bundled together with piracy, which could be as simple as just downloading an illegal copy of a movie and watching it at home for non-profit reasons. In full acknowledgement that it is a dodgy copy, perhaps.
So essentially, it's the same punishment, or at least the same law, for overseeing counterfeit medicines on
yes.
a massive commercial scale as maybe having a blog that posts dodgy videos on it.
Yeah, exactly. So
very broad and Europe-wide.
Not Europe-wide, worldwide. We've got signatories to the US, Canada, Japan, Korea, Morocco, New Zealand, Singapore, and now Europe. And there are many other countries that they're trying to get involved with in ACTA as well.
And if this isn't going to go through sort of the traditional political process of discussion and voting and things like that, What can we do about this?
Well, there is still time. So this week, Europe signed up, made a commitment towards ACTA, but it's not fully sealed, a done deal, basically.
So it's still, even though, so we've essentially said, yes, we support this, but it still has to go through an approval and a vote.
Yeah, there will be a vote in European Parliament. So that's scheduled for around June. So between now and June, all the various different industry committees within the European Union have to decide on whether they support or don't support ACTA. So there's time now to lobby all these various different committees, who are then going to feed into a central report with something called the International Trade Association. And then that report's going to be delivered to the European Parliament, and then they're going to base their vote on that, the findings of that report. So what you can do now is contact your MEPs, and I think we've got links on the website if you search for ACTA, of where to find their contact details, and you can tell them that you don't support this new trade agreement.
And obviously we've got comment sections on those websites if you want to let us know what you think. And also podcast@wired.co.uk if you have a view. But that wasn't the only other thing that went on in the legal world. There's something, I say slightly more close to home. Europe is very close to home. But over in Ireland, there is kind of a debate going on about the Irish equivalent to SOPA, which we discussed in great detail last week, which is another massively controversial law governing intellectual property. So what the hell is going on here? What's wrong with the Irish legal system?
Yeah, well, Ireland's very shortly, apparently by the end of January, is going to be passing a law that would let music and movie companies force Irish ISPs to block access to sites suspected of having copyright infringing material. But the law is not being voted for in Irish Parliament. It's being kind of pushed through by ministerial decree, I think it's called, something like that.
And why? Who's instigated this then?
Well, it's kind of been spurned by a case with EMI against the Irish government. EMI complained that the Irish government wasn't doing enough to curb piracy. And the Irish government found that it was the case that their copyright was being breached, but there were no laws in place to address the situation. So they kind of rushed through this piece of legislation, to, which actually supposedly falls in line with an EU directive that they kind of have to have some means of acting against copyright infringing websites. But Ireland doesn't have a particularly good track record when it comes to site blocking, and it seems to have been swayed very heavily by the content owners. For example, in 2009, the largest internet service provider, Aircom, had to agree to block access to any website that the music industry said was responsible for illegal downloads.
And of course, this is bad because this has a very chilling effect on free speech. I mean, the music industry can basically say, this website is, you know, allowing file swapping,
yeah,
and then it's forced to, it's Aircom and other ISPs are forced to take it down.
Yeah, I mean, the legislation does say they have to take into account freedom of speech on the balance and the rights of the rights holders. However, we've seen...
But how does the website owner... Is there any comeback, you know?
Yeah, well, I think...
Is there any appeals process to this?
I mean, we've seen this with sort of stuff like the DMCA in America, where, you know, it's very, very easy for major companies, I'm not naming any names, to just blanket send out massive, massive requests for takedown, even on content that perhaps they know isn't actually incriminating.
But the thing about that is it's individual pieces of content, whereas this would be blocking at the site level. And I think that's that goes a lot further.
So if someone posted something bad, you know, a video that was infringing copyright on wired.co.uk, essentially we can be blocked.
Yeah, or a social networking site, or, you know, YouTube, etc., etc.
So if people in Ireland are concerned about this, we've got a story on the website as well, which has some details about how people can protest and lobby their local government bodies, I guess, if they search for, what, Ireland SOPA?
Ireland SOPA.
I think there's also a website that gives more information at stopsopaireland.com as well, so you can visit that too.
Well, I think we've talked enough about legal stuff for the time being, but very important, and we're going to move from SOPA into SOAP.
Yay!
You were hoping I was going to say that, weren't
that
you?
That was my favourite link of the podcast.
I was going to go for, well, it's time to wash our hands of that story with some SOAP. But the news is that a team of scientists, chemists in fact, at the University of Bristol have developed a type of liquid SOAP. It's the kind you see in a squirty little carton. I don't really know why I felt the need to explain what liquid SOAP was.
He's making a sort of squirty little carton motion. Listeners can't see this, but it's very attractive.
I was thinking more bad.
Thanks, Liv. I'm glad no one could see what you just did.
That's soap.
That looks ominous.
Soap,
that's ominous.
Dispenser.
And it's a type of soap that could help clean up oil spills in the world's seas. At least that's one of the most popular potential uses for this thing. And what it is, it's the first soap sensitive to essentially to magnets, and means that soap could, for example, be safely removed from the sea after being used to break down oil after an oil spill, which is amazing. No one's ever been able to essentially magnetize a liquid like this.
So how does it actually work?
Well, what they've done is they created these particles and they've given them very metallic centers, which will be responsive to magnets. What it does is it kind of lets the soap overcome the twin effects of gravity and the surface tension between water and oil in order to kind of rise up like any surfactant through the solvent and reach the magnet, letting it be controlled, essentially.
And we've talked about this as being potentially useful in oil spills. I mean, one of the problems with using soap, which is used to help clean up oil spills, is that although you might get rid of the oil, you're then leaving a whole giant bunch of soap in the sea, which might not be as bad as oil, but it's certainly not good. And this would allow the oil to be quite easily removed. But it could also be used in things like water treatment, you know, I guess sewage plants and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you give this soap the ability to kind of respond to this magnetic stimuli, you can change all kinds of properties, electrical conductivity or how easily they dissolve, by just turning a magnet on and off. Normally you have to add an electrical a charge to the mixture, or change the pH or the temperature or its pressure or something to change these factors. And if you could just flip a magnet on and off, that would make it much, much more easy to do cool things with soap.
Yeah, it's potentially really good news for environmentalists as well, because obviously oil spills, not environmentally friendly, and the cleanup operations involved aren't necessarily that environmentally friendly either. Setting fire to the top of the sea, for example, not being massively healthy to anything trying to get through the fire to feed. I think it's still quite a way away from being commercialized, but it could start being used in research for such sort of industrial cleanup uses and things like that. So pretty cool stuff from Bristol. Fashion earns a Warcraft player a whole lot of gold, Duncan. The world, yeah. Warcraft, world of.
Yeah, World of Warcraft, if you're not familiar with it, most of you probably will be, is a huge, massively multiplayer online role-playing game. More people play World of Warcraft than live in Greece. It's enormous. It's a very, very big game.
And I didn't know that fact. That's amazing.
Did you not? Yeah, it's huge. There's like 14 million people or something along those lines.
But it's
lines,
not
anyway.
Known for its fashion.
It's not known for its fashion. And one enterprising player has taken a rather unusual path to earning a lot of in-game money, becoming a bit of a sort of fashion mogul.
Why? No, in fact, no. How? Because...
That's your other question that you always ask me.
I just want to ask why and how. I mean, the game is about fighting stuff, so you're buying armor. What does it matter if it's fashionable?
Well, a recent patch of World of Warcraft added this feature called transmogrification. Normally in role-playing games, you generally collect sort of armor and swords and things like that that have increasing stats. So it might do +5 stabbiness, and then if you find a sword that does +8 stabbiness, you're going to swap it for that one instead. And what that means is the look of your character changes, because you have to swap your old sword for the new sword. And what transmogrification does is it lets the new stuff, the stuff with the +8 stabbiness, look like the sword of +5 stabbiness. So if you prefer how the 5-1 looks, you can swap them over.
Okay, so it's like the world's geekiest edition of the clothes show. Is that still on?
I suppose so, yeah.
I have no idea.
But this chap called Keelhaul, who's also become known as the Mogfather, as in transmogrification, knew that it was coming up and decided that he wanted to try and prove that there was a fashion market in World of Warcraft. So what he did is he stockpiled loads and loads of different armor from that was essentially useless at that point, because nobody wanted to use it. It had very low stats on it. But it looked pretty. And he got all of that. And then when the patch hit, he started selling it on the auction house for vast amounts of money, and has earned himself an absolute fortune. Anyway, this guy found that he was so incredibly successful that he hit the gold cap in the game, which is the maximum amount of gold one player can have, which is 1 million. And he hit it in just 45 days. So he needed something to do with all of those riches so that he could carry on actually earning money off it. So he started giving it away and gave out 400,000 gold to a single player, and then promptly got banned because the Blizzard's bots thought he was a gold farmer.
You can't actually spend that money, can you?
No, I mean, there's no way of directly exchanging that for real world money, but you know, you can still get some fun out of it within the game. So yeah, he started giving out things to random players, but eventually he got bored of that, and now what he does instead is he holds fashion shows within the game with hundreds of players strutting around in their outfits, and he gives the best ones big cash prizes.
I think he probably could make money if he wanted to, though. He could always advertise on eBay that I'm selling this cloth or this amount of gold and accept the money over like PayPal and then transfer it in game.
Yeah,
I mean, technically he could do that.
If Blizzard caught him, it's against the terms of service. So if Blizzard caught him, he would get banned for doing that. I think he's quite content just to enjoy it for the challenge of it, for the challenge of making money. I think that's why he did it in the first place.
Well, in another really quick bit of game news, someone is developing a first-person shooter online that can have 1,000 people playing each other at once.
Yes, this is an attempt to set a world record. A Swedish non-profit called Much Different is hosting a 1,000-player online game.
I just wanted to mention this because I know that one of our guys has got a place set up that he's going to be taking part in this. And I wanted to mention to anyone listening, if they want to be part of this, because I think it will set a new world record. I don't actually know if there is an existing world record, but certainly going to set one. How can people get involved in this first-person shooter?
It's a browser thing. So all you have to do is be there at the right time. The game had to be specially designed so that it didn't break when so many people were playing at the same time. Most games wouldn't be able to cope with that amount of people. And as a result, they've had to, even then, they've had to limit it to 1,000. If you want to take part, there is a link in our story, which is on the website. If you search for something like Swedish FPS world record, then you should find it. But it looks like it'll be quite good fun.
Yeah, definitely. Although the idea of being the maintenance guy on a server that's got to host 1,000 people playing together at the same time, makes my head hurt. Anyway, speaking of temples, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about
temples.
atheists. Temples being built for atheists.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. I think I confused Duncan with my link there. Temples, you know, my head hurt. I have temples. We're going to talk about temples.
Yeah, it makes sense now. I just think you would have confused the listeners beforehand because you then started talking about ad breaks.
Well, Liv was smiling. She got it. Liv got it.
Keep up.
Anyway, we are talking about atheist temples, and this is a philosopher called Alain de Botton, who was actually on the show a little later, but more of that in a bit. And he has called for a series of temples for atheists to be built around the UK.
What is a temple for an atheist?
Well, you know how organized religions have temples. We have, you know, churches and mosques and
places to worship.
Places to worship. And he sort of thinks, well, these buildings are gorgeous. Why should just the religious people have these amazing temples to talk about the things that they love? So he has begun work on a temple. And the first of these is being designed by Tom Greenall Architects. And it's going to be, it's a concept at the moment for a tower standing 46 meters high in London, which apparently represents the 4.6 billion year age of the Earth. 4.6 billion years, 46 million meters tall.
Okay, and what's the point of this?
Well, the whole point really, I mean, he argues, is that a set of non-religious temples could inspire a sense of perspective, you know, and could be a place to go to talk about music and good things.
So it's kind of about inspiring people to think about things that aren't necessarily religious in nature, but are still good and positive.
Moral.
And
exactly. But I find the idea of a temple for atheists being a bit, as cool as I like it, and speaking, you know, as an atheist, I like the idea in a sense, but I kind of think on a base level, it's the idea of building a building to go and talk about the stuff you don't believe in. It's like when you go to church, you go there to talk about your belief in God, not your disbelief in a God.
Well, I think it's not about disbelief.
I know it's
not.
I know it's
talking about the fact that people who don't believe in God can also have values and appreciation of things in the world that have higher significance.
Absolutely. It's just the nature of kind of the opposite of religion having a thing to represent itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, his design here is it's all about perspective, right?
Yeah.
And it's got this 4.6 billion year representing 46 meter tall black tower. And what it's got at the very bottom is a millimeter thick band of gold that represents humanity's existence during those 4.6 billion years.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of like, it's a sobering thought. And I think the idea of this building is to inspire that sobering thought in people and make sure people remember that there's a bit more in the world than just humanity.
Do you know what I think it is, actually? I think it's a way to inspire people to remember that he's got a new book coming out. I actually doubt whether this will ever get built, but I like the concept of it nonetheless anyway. And Alan will, of course, as we said, be on the show a little later on, but we're going to move on. A computer system, Liv, has been designed for recognizing users by their shoes.
Yes.
Would they be computer shoesers?
if you like.
Thanks.
This is a team of computer science researchers at Hasso Plattner Institute in Potsdam in Germany.
In our prep, you gave it an accent.
I know. I just realised it might have been a bit offensive and also just a bit wrong.
All right.
But they've developed this system that is meant to be used for shared computers, which identifies people by the shoes when they put them underneath the table. And what they did is they specifically designed it for use with a large touchscreen surface, and they were using Microsoft's Surface so that you could identify different people who are touching the surface at the same time, which has been a notoriously difficult problem to solve. And they've had previous attempts using things like infrared, yeah. Mm. Infrared rings and kind of bum sensors on seats. But what this does is it has Kinect cameras pointing down towards the floor and detects the patterns and size and shape of people's shoes under the desk.
So would you have to register your feet, in a sense?
Yeah, you'd have to associate your pairs of shoes with your user profile.
What if someone had the same pair of shoes?
Well, that would make it a little bit trickier. And
what if you stole someone's shoes? Like, I could be looking at Duncan's shoes right now, and essentially, I'm stealing his password.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's meant to be used for highly secure transactions, but it's more about kind of collaborative workspaces and maybe educational purposes.
I see.
But they tested it, and they had 18 users with 18 different pairs of shoes, and they found it to be about 89% accurate. So
this is one of the more obscure examples of new ways to kind of interact with a machine without touching it. We've seen obviously iris scanning and things like that, and obviously fingerprint scanning for a long time. We're starting to see things like facial recognition, where laptops with built-in webcams can actually recognize your face when you walk up to it, and unlock the computer or even the phone. I think there's a phone that can do facial recognition. There might be one or two. And it's just this new interesting way. And I've seen vocal patterns as well. We've seen that in movies a lot, but it is actually something that can exist.
I feel like this would work very, very well in places like design agencies. And marketing companies, but not so well in maybe banks.
No, and I got this kind of idea when I was thinking about this, about banks wanting to maybe use this tool, but then having a whole set of like animal feet slippers at the door so they could put them on, and someone would be Big Bird and someone else would be Monster Feet, and then you'd be able to interact with it.
It is a bit bizarre. I could see this being used in, you know, like in a bar, maybe like your feet are scanned on entry.
Yeah.
And then maybe...
your favourite drinks get delivered.
You know, it knows when you've sat at the table, and it knows, oh, would you like the regular, you tap yes on the little surface thing and the regular comes over. I could see some uses for this. I just wonder what would happen if, you know, someone happened to be wearing the same set of shoes next to you. As is the nature of fashion, people like to copy each other.
Indeed.
I know. That said, everyone, I think the most popular password in the world is 123456. And if you have that, and I imagine several people listening have.
You should be shocked.
Well, change your password. It's less secure than a foot. Last story we've got here before we move on is, it involves moon bases. Duncan, I'm going to let you explain the whole thing.
Yeah, US presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich has promised the American people that if he's elected president in the next election, if he's if he gets the Republican nomination and then he's elected president, he will build a moon base on the moon by the end of his second term in office.
You know, I like that the fact that in our sort of list of notes here about each of our stories, the next item in your list is lol.
Yeah.
Which is very appropriate, because it strikes me that we could have built a moon base and we haven't yet. And Obama's pretty keen on space, and bloke before him was.
Bloke before him. George Bush? George Bush. Remember him?
Total mind blank.
to be fair, it wouldn't be completely out of the realms of possibility for this to happen. Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon, and managed it.
But within 8 years.
It does seem rather unlikely that that Gingrich is going to be able to do this. He does have competition from Mitt Romney, who's the other front runner for the Republican nomination, who kind of wants to develop the space program further, and especially military in space. Mm. He definitely believes space should be a priority, but it's kind of hard not to see this as both of them posturing in an election year, essentially.
I think so. I mean, you could spend 8 years doing the R&D on just how to put a base on the moon, let alone actually building the technology to do that, install it, send people to actually work in it. I mean, unless I suppose we talked a while ago about kind of inflatable moon bases, and these are sort of little, almost temporary moon bases that you can sort of shove in a moon cave and inflate, and you've essentially got a livable environment for a short period of time. He means one of those.
It feels a bit like having a kind of baby rattle and rattling it to distract everyone from their terrible tackle other home policies.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an aspect of that too.
But almost a little bit like trying to pass a law under an agriculture movement
exactly.
when it's actually about piracy.
But Gingrich's sort of wider space policy is about sort of cutting bureaucracy at NASA and expanding the private sector space programs. He wants to take 10% of NASA's budget, which is quite a lot of money, and put it up as prizes for technology competitions for people to develop this this technology. And the interesting thing here is that Kennedy's plan for putting a man on the moon was more of a challenge. He wanted to say to the American people, can we do this? And it turned out that they could. Mm. And that was so inspiring. Whereas I think Newt saying, yes, we're definitely going to do this, that's a rather different approach.
There was, of course, the element of competition between Russia and, of course, now competition with China. I'm sure that's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah, the kind of geopolitics, I think, are rather different today than they were back in the height of the Cold War. But
true.
It is an interesting issue. I don't think it's terribly likely that China's going to be putting anything on the moon within 8 years, but we'll see.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to leave the news section on planet Earth and soar through the heavens into our moon base.
Which we haven't told anyone about.
No.
Hello, Katie. Welcome to our moon base.
Thank you very much.
One thing we've been meaning to do on the podcast for a while now is talk a little bit about the background behind some of the stories that we publish in the print version of Wired, the magazine. And we thought this would be a great opportunity to do it because in the most recent issue is the Smart List. What's the Smart List, Katie?
Well, basically, the magazine team went out and they spoke to all sorts of experts in their field to find out from them who the people we should be watching for years to come. So people who aren't necessarily doing something exciting now, but have the potential to be doing great things in 2, 3, 5, 10 years time.
Okay, so who have you spoken to?
I spoke to Greg Williams, who's executive editor on the magazine, to get him to explain how the whole project came about.
Every month, what we do is we want to show our readers what's coming up next. So whether that's people or trends or technology, and we're used to kind of, you know, highlighting a lot of people that we see at conferences or people we read about online who are doing things right now. And we just thought one day, well, you know what? There's a lot of people who are doing interesting things now, and we wanted to know what they thought was interesting about what's coming next, so beyond the current wave into the future. So we asked them to sort of think about who they might like to nominate as the kind of the coming brains of the future, as it were, the people who are doing really innovative, interesting things who will be writing, you know, big features on in sort of like the next 2, 3, 4 years. So whether that's sort of physicists or whether it's astronomers or economists or human rights activists, we wanted to know kind of the people that maybe were sort of just coming onto our radar, and who better to ask than the people who are doing the most exciting things at the moment. So we went out, you know, sort of fairly wide to really ask, you know, some of the world's kind of most exciting and influential people. So we asked everyone from Ai Weiwei, the Chinese artist, Richard Branson, Melinda Gates from the Gates Foundation, Alain de Botton, the philosopher. And what was interesting about it was that there were some people that we were kind of, you know, were aware of, people who were doing great work at places like MIT, but there are also a lot of people who we were kind of, you know, really excited to hear about. So there's a really kind of nice mix of people that you might expect to see on a list like this, people like Joy Ito from MIT, but also some really nice new fresh names for, you know, us and the readers to learn about.
You've got a massive broad range of people within the piece, not only in terms of the people who've done the nominations, but the people that they've nominated. Was it hard choosing the people to go to in the very first place?
It was quite hard, because what we wanted to do is we wanted to make sure that each of them had a degree of excellence, if you like. We wanted them to be kind of hugely credible innovators in their own right, and that's what would make their nominations interesting. So we had to make sure that, you know, as pretty much everything we do in Wired, we had to make sure the bar was set really high, so that, you know, their nominations did have that kind of real power and weight to them.
And is this something that we're going to carry on? Are we going to be doing the Smart List for years to come?
It nearly killed us putting it together. but yes, I'd like to think we will do it next year.
But Greg wasn't the only person you spoke to, is that right?
Yeah, I also managed to track down some of the people who had put nominations forward. So some of the people who are these experts and had put someone forward who they thought we should be watching. And the first of these was the philosopher Alain de Botton.
So I nominated John Armstrong because he's one of the rare people who can deal with the really big issues of life, nothing short of what civilization is for and about, and can speak on these subjects in a really clear way that engages with our own experience and makes sense of the world. So he's fulfilling the brief that all philosophers should have, which is to elucidate, explain, and bring wisdom to the problems that we all suffer from.
Here's Jill Tarter, the astronomer, on her nomination, Margaret Turnbull, the astrobiologist.
Maggie is one of the new breed of astrobiologists. She actually has a PhD that came from a program of studies she herself created at her university because it was not possible to do a PhD in astrobiology before she went through. And she has combined the kinds of in-depth studies that I would like to have had in molecular biology and chemistry and astronomy for this new field. I think Maggie's going to do great things in the future. She's at a time in a field which is just exploding as we learn about more and more and more exoplanets. And we're interested in life on those planets or the potential for life on those planets. And Maggie is one of a number of young people who are just grabbing this entire new field and running with it.
And last up, I managed to corner Graham Lasseau, a very famous footballer, but he's now a broadcaster in his own right, and here's his nomination.
I nominated Vanessa Berlewitz because I feel that she's sort of an unsung hero of our of the last year with the work that she does behind the scenes in producing all the natural history programmes for the BBC. And I just think that getting environmental issues up on the sort of the broader agenda and recognition for these issues is key to protecting habitats and species over the coming years. And how they do it at the BBC using new technology really, from my point of view, allows the broader public to engage with the issues and develop their own sort of ideas about what we should do to protect these environments.
Thanks, Katie. Well, anyone looking to read that feature can find it in the magazine this month, which is on all good newspaper shelves right now and on the iPad.
Yeah, and you can, or you can just come and read it on the website for free.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
That's true.
It's a bit easier.
You could do that as well. And that's going to tie up the news. Liv, are you depressed that we have finished a podcast for another week?
I'm a little depressed, but I feel invigorated, Nate.
This is good. I'm invigorated too. I'm going to let Duncan invigorate us, though, by telling us how people can get in touch.
I'm just a bit tired, actually. But if you want to
fine. Liv, tell us how people get in touch.
No,
I haven't heard Liv's voice for a while.
Always ask her. You never ask me to read out the things anymore.
Yeah, but you've just been talking
to Katie. Yes. So. Liv, how do people get in touch?
Well, you can follow us on Twitter, first of all. We're on @WiredUK.
@WiredUK.
And Duncan's going to tell us how you can follow us on Facebook.
You can follow us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/WiredUK. What's that web address?
/WiredUK.
Yeah. And if you want to talk about how pointless the last 30 seconds of arguing has been, email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. And we'll all see you for another wonderful argument next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.